Treatment of Animals has just updated their animal control statistics for 2005, and the numbers aren't pretty. According to the Virginia State Veterinarian, PETA killed 1,946 cats, dogs, and other pets last year, in addition to 141 wild animals. In 2005, PETA managed a startling 90% kill rate, up from 86% the year before, adopting or transferring out only 215 animals. Added to PETA's earlier numbers, these new figures tell us that since July 1998, the group has killed over 14,400 cats, dogs, and other pets just in the state of Virginia. And this is the Hellbound Alley program. I'm Allie, and with me, of course, is Frank.
Yes.
And that was an article about PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and their lovely kill rate.
Yeah. So you shouldn't kill animals, but they're okay.
As you know, PETA groups protest other dog pounds and humane society shelters, which have shown to have much better animal adoption rates than PETA does. So
10%. Yeah, that sounds pretty bad.
Pretty bad.
Well, you know, we don't know about the specifics of it. They also have a nice picture here of the death kit that PETA has there. So that's really nice. This is and the article ends by saying that PETA bragged in it last October about bringing back 32 dogs from Hurricane Katrina.
Said, oh, yes.
Judging by their percentages, we're getting at least 29 of them have already met their demise. Yeah, that's
thanks,
really sad.
PETA, and I'm sure the valuable time of our celebrities is well spent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's pretty bad. Have you, I guess that's all we have to say about that.
What else is there to say?
Well, you know, we've talked about PETA a bit on our last show about vegetarianism, which I guess, I don't know, it didn't have that much to do with PETA, but we find the occasion to talk about it. So I guess we've already said a lot of what we're going to say about PETA anyway. By the way, you forgot to say we have a guest today.
Oh, yes. Sorry about that. Today we have our good friend Stefan Molyneux of Free Domain Radio with us. Hello, Stefan.
Hello, hello. How's it going?
Well, we're good, and we're having a nice evening here in Montreal. This is a little bit different for us. We're usually recording in the morning, but it's a nice cold evening on St. Patrick's Day, and I'd like to congratulate everyone on being Irish. I know you sacrificed a lot to be Irish, including our good friend Stefan.
Oh, yeah.
It was work, boy, let me tell you.
And I just wanted to know, like, what's so bad about snakes? I really don't understand. I mean, snakes provide a valuable service eating rodents. So maybe St. Patrick, maybe he did something else great that we should acknowledge him for.
Well, you know, the only thing I can say about that is that I think that the Irish are a fairly practical group of people. So we don't care so much about the water and the wine and the walking on the water. We want something sort of practical, which is to get the snakes out of Ireland. And so we don't go for all of that frou-frou Catholic stuff really so much that goes on down in the Mediterranean where they have such nice weather they can get impressed by that kind of stuff. We want something practical, like our miracles involve someone's going to come over and dust your house in the middle of the night. That's what we really, that's our religion. That's why we have leprechauns, right? They use a pot of gold. That's what we want. We don't want anything in the afterlife. We just want the straight-up goods, useful material stuff right now.
Well, sure, it's useful, but...
Well, it's funny you say that because the St. Patrick's thing about it, chasing of the snakes is actually a symbolic of the chasing of the Druids. Because what happened historically is that this St. Patrick was trying to evangelize Ireland, but the Druids were the main religious force there. And so he thought that he should convert the Druids, but they were pretty happy with their own religion and so on. But as you know, the Druidic thing is centered around holy places. So what St. Patrick did was to take to the hammer, and he destroyed the Druidic holy places. So
by himself? With a hammer?
I don't know if he did it alone, but that's the story of it, is that the chasing of the snakes is a symbolic of the chasing of the Druids, the chasing of the traditional religion that was there.
That sounds about right. Does that sound right to you, Stefan?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, wherever a new religion goes in, it always balks the existing. When you look at the Old Testament, you realize it's just coming, they just took everything that came into a big bag so they didn't have to change too many of the rituals.
Right. So it's actually, it seems having a little problem.
Okay,
I don't know what's going on there.
We'll check
but
that.
But if you hear Stefan going in and out a little bit, don't worry about it. I'm sure it'll correct itself.
So, in the celebrity news, I know you all need to hear about this on a glorious whacking day. It says here that Katie Holmes is just days away from giving birth to the baby she's expecting with Tom Cruise. And, of course, Katie Holmes will be giving birth in the Scientology way. New mothers can't scream about pain so that the child can enter the world in total silence, which means Katie Holmes will be allowed to moan. That doesn't sound like total silence. But she cannot say anything, neither can she ask for painkillers. Scientology also encourages delivering in a room filled with happy, positively minded people, which means in turn that Katie Holmes' parents are likely to be left waiting outside. Holmes' clan has repeatedly expressed their concerns over Katie's interest in Scientology. However, Tom Cruise's entourage, including two sisters, devoted Scientologists, and two adopted children, also practicing Scientologists, will no doubt be allowed into the delivery room. So, there you have it.
Yeah, we already talked about the weird...
You know, I don't know if the baby really can... I don't know what's going on with their ears at
that
point.
Well, you don't want to give them any bad Ingrams that they'll have.
Right, exactly. They're going to have implanted bad feelings or something. And I don't know. I just thought that the babies were sort of, their ears and their eyes and their noses are all fleshed out with the little squeegee things. So, I don't know. I suppose if your ears are filled with fluid, yelling can kind of be a little bit painful. But other than that, I'm sure that a bunch of people smiling doesn't really mean much to the baby at that point. He hasn't learned yet that smiling is positive, so...
Good point.
But as far as her parents being concerned, I can only imagine that the research they might have done on what Scientology really is as opposed to what she's learning. People have to be filling them in on Xenu and clams and the volcanoes and all of that weird L. Ron Hubbard going to Venus kind of stuff.
Exactly.
And, yeah, if I were her mother, I'd be concerned as well. But then again, they brought her up in Catholicism, so what exactly is worse?
Yeah, definitely.
Who knows?
Who's weirder? Why don't you go ahead and give our coordinates?
Well, yes. More of our episodes can be heard on our website at hellboundalley.com, and you can email us at allie@hellboundalley.com, and I'd like to say I really enjoyed my most recent email from an admirer. Thank you very much for that lovely,
get a lot of admirers,
lovely email. But yes, I am married, by the way. You guys do understand.
No, you shouldn't tell them that. You shouldn't tell people you're married. You should give them the expectation of the fantasy.
I kind of assumed you all knew that Frank and I here, we are actually legally married in the province of Quebec.
You have to keep them, give them the fantasy that they might be with you someday. That's how it works in the celebrity
world. Well, I am a modern woman.
All right. Well, this is part two of the How to Argue Morality, and we did have a part one, which kind of didn't really get into how to argue morality, because we kind of got sidetracked.
Probably my fault.
Sidetracked, yes. So, Stefan, I guess the most obvious topic in how to argue morality would be the moral argument.
Yes.
So, why don't you go ahead and maybe give our listeners who didn't hear our first show where we talked about that somewhat got into that. Talk about what the moral argument is and how you can use it to argue for market anarchy, libertarianism, and also to a certain extent it also applies to atheism. So there's a lot of different areas there.
Sure, I'd be happy to. What I found to be the most powerful argument to bring people around to the idea of liberty is to say, when somebody says something like, you know, you can sort of pick any topic, right? Let's say taxation. Right? Oh, we need to have taxes for X, Y, and Z. The way that I approach that with people now, and I think it's been helpful, is to say something like, well, that's interesting. Now, you think that we need to have taxes and that that's the moral thing to do, and so you get them to admit or to talk about their interest in these things from a moral standpoint, which is good, right? It's very important to talk about ethics, so everybody's happy to do it. And then what I ask them is, okay, so if you think there should be taxes, is that just your opinion? Like, you like sunflowers and you like Coca-Cola and you like blue instead of green, it's just your opinion, or is it like a fact? Is it a universal fact that's an absolute, or is it just your opinion? Now, of course, nobody really likes to just say that they have these moral beliefs that they think everybody should obey, but it's just their opinion. Because as soon as somebody says, it's just my opinion, then immediately they can't tell anyone else what to do. Right? I mean, that's, I might like a certain band, but that doesn't mean that everyone else has to like it, because that's just a personal preference. It's like personal aesthetics. So nobody likes to say, well, it's just my opinion. So then the next thing that they're going to say is, no, it's an absolute fact, right? If we need taxes, blah, 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 it's an absolute fact.
Why, of course.
And then what you can say is, okay, well, sort of step me through, explain it to me like I'm 3 years old, because I always have, I play dumb, right? I mean, sometimes it's not even playing dumb, because people have some pretty strange opinions.
But right, exactly. You have to get them to explain their contradictory premises to you. So you have to start from the perspective of someone who doesn't already have all those prejudices and rationalizations.
Right. So you talk as if, you know, you're from another planet, you know. Explain to me this earthling concept of taxation, and I find that's kind of helpful, right? So they say, well, the government should do this, the government, I said, okay, it's too complicated for me already. You know, could you ever watch the old show Columbo, you know? Explain it to me simply, like I don't understand, you know? And that I found to be pretty helpful. And so they say, okay, well, the government should do this. I said, okay, I don't understand. She was saying, and I use like a pair of, I've got a salt and pepper shaker on the table. Like, I mean, I find that very helpful. Like, you just got to dumb it down and stop people from overcomplicating stuff with propagandistic slogans and crap like that. So for me, I like, I get a salt shaker and a pepper if I'm at dinner with someone. Salt shaker, pepper shaker, right? So I said, okay, so there's this one guy here, and he has the right to take money from this guy. Because why? Like, help me understand that. It's like, oh, because, you know, they voted him in, and all, you know, all the nonsense that we've all heard about a million times. And then you say, okay, so you're saying it's a choice, right? So the government, the guy in the government is taking money from the guy who's not in the government, but the guy who's not in the government doesn't have any objections, right? Because he voted him in, and he's happy and all that, right? And they say, well, yeah, because, you know, everyone believes this democratic nonsense about free will. And so then you say, okay, well, help me understand this then, because if it's a choice, why is it enforced at the point of a gun, right? Like, I mean, if I say that a woman wants to make love with me, and at the same time I've got a gun out, you know, somebody might question my romantic intentions, right? So, you know, that's the part I don't understand. If it's a choice, if we all want to pay taxes, then it seems kind of inefficient too, right? I mean, if we all want to pay taxes, why do we need all this overhead of, you know, 10,000 volumes of tax laws and tax lawyers and police and jail and all that kind of stuff, right? We just write a check and everyone's happy to do it. And they say, well, no, of course, some people have to be forced to do it. And it's like, okay, well, here I'm starting to sort of get really confused because you're saying it's a choice, but you're saying it's not a choice. And if it is a choice, we don't need taxes. If it's not a choice, then I don't understand why this guy represented by the salt shaker gets to point a gun at the guy represented by the pepper shaker and tell him what to do. Is it like a universal, everyone gets to do that? Like, can you switch the guns and have them point the other way? Is that equally moral? Like, I just don't understand. And that really helps people to realize that what they're advocating is a one-way monopolistic use of violence against people who are usually legally disarmed.
Right.
And that's a whole lot different from we want everyone to get health care, right? I mean, you've got to get people out of the rhetoric and into the facts of the situation, which are a lot more simple than they're talking about. And so I found that approach, you know, break it down, play dumb, explain it to me like I'm 3 years old, and I find using physical objects is really helpful because it's so abstract. I love to have a whiteboard, so I mean, if I'm talking to someone in my office, if I'm taking my career in my hands and I'm talking about it with someone in my office, I can whiteboard it and I can say, like, I was having an argument with one guy in my office. He was talking about how, you know, he said, well, here's a great thing that the government did. The government freed the slaves. Right? Right? I mean, that to me is just
wow.
Amazing. It's like you watch one film about Lincoln, and suddenly you're an expert on, you know, Civil War legislation. And I said, well, okay, I understand that. Maybe you believe that, and that's certainly an interesting belief. So basically the government advocated slavery for, you know, what, 10,000 years, protected slave owners, caught the slaves and sent them back, managed and taxed the sale of slaves. And then let's just say, and I know it's not true, but let's just say that Lincoln then woke up one morning and said, by golly, I think the slavery thing's just got to go. And then he went and did that. And I said, well, how did he do that? It's like, well, he had a civil war. And I said, well, did you know how many people died in the civil war? And they say, oh, I don't know. When I watched Gone with the Wind, it didn't look like that many people. And so then I say, well, you know, like 600,000 men and women and children were killed in the civil war, right? So I said, the issue there is not, you know, even if we say that there was some magic thing that they got rid of slavery, does it make sense to say to someone, you have to go and get killed, the government has the right to take you out of your home at gunpoint, put you in the army, put you in front of people, you don't even know who they are, and you're shooting at them already, they're shooting at you, the cannon's taken off your head and stuff. And it's the relationship not between the government and the slaves, but between the government and the soldiers that really worries me at this point. You know, like, let's deal with slavery another time. And so just getting people to understand that it's all just people, right? There's no such thing as the government. There's no such thing as countries or the military or the church or anything. There's just all priests. There's just people.
And right, right, because...
go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. People would say if you say if it's a... If paying taxes is a choice, then why do we need to enforce it? And people invariably say, we have to force people to pay taxes because people are bad and greedy and they don't want to help the poor and they don't want to give money to educate the people, so we have to force them because they're bad. But then,
right.
Of course, you're saying if people are bad, then what's the government?
Then if the people are bad, then what's the point of having a democratic system anyway?
Like you're because what's the government made of?
Yeah, absolutely. And
people.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know, you're absolutely right. I mean, I won't go into it in great depth, but there's sort of four possibilities, right? Either people are all evil, in which case the last thing you'd want is a monopoly of power, right? The last thing you'd want is a government in a situation where everybody is evil.
Mm-hmm.
Or people are mostly evil, and there's a few good people around, in which case the last thing you want is a democracy, and the only thing you can logically advocate is for this sort of platonic republic of philosopher kings, which sadly never seems to exist, right? You just get all evil people. Or people are mostly good, but there are a few evil people, in which case you could argue for a democracy, but the problem is that evil people love to do evil when they can escape the consequences of doing evil, so the first place they're going to go to is the government. So then you're going to get all these evil people in charge of all these good people. That doesn't make any sense at all. And also, if people are mostly good and only a little bit evil, then they will help the poor anyway, and they will help the sick, and, you know, people will be nice and do the right thing. And then the other option, of course, is that people are all good and there's no such thing as evil, which is, A, logically indefensible, and B, even if you could defend it, you still wouldn't need a government. So under no circumstances can a government ever be said to be justified on any argument of sort of the distribution of good or evil within society.
Well, the general problem is that if there's any transcendent good in society and in individuals, democracy is the worst possible way of trying to give it any power, because the democratic system inherently favors the most corrupt, unctuous, dishonest individuals.
Right, and also
that's the whole point.
If people do say as well, I mean, if and the people can't look at sort of one aspect of the government in isolation from anything else, right? It's like the doctor saying to me, you know, when my arm's fallen off, well, your little toe is really healthy, so you don't need me. So you can't do that. So what I say to people is to say, okay, well, so you say that people are mostly evil. Well, who had control of the children's minds for 14 years? You can't just sort of say, well, people are evil and that's why we need a government, because at the moment, of course, and for the last 140-odd years, the government has been completely in control of educating the young. So if people are evil, that's the last thing you'd ever want, is to have a government, because obviously this is what the government produces, is evil people. So you can't use, you know, the fact that government power produces evil people to justify government power.
It's funny because you're reminding me of a quote that I read, which was, people complain, I don't remember the exact quote, but the gist of it was, people complain how we need public education because people won't educate their children properly. And that shows that we should abolish public education because look at the kind of parents it produced.
Right.
You
right,
understand
right,
it?
Right.
I thought that was a great quote.
That's very good. That's very good. I read one the other day, which I really like, which I can't remember who said it. Something like, government is a fiction by which everyone expects or hopes to live at the expense of everybody else.
Yes, yes. Excellent quote. Excellent quote. So would you say that the moral argument, the general form is, when presented with a system where there's a ruling class, or however you want to call it, a group of individuals, a class of individuals that have the power to inflict coercion on others for whatever reason, and then you have the rest of the population, you can point out that the rule is inconsistent because it applies only to the ruling class and not to people who are outside of it.
Yeah, I think...
Is that a good way of generalizing the argument?
I think that's a good way of putting it, for sure. I mean, morality has no power if it is not universal, because then it's just an aesthetic opinion, right? Like, I like tank tops as opposed to t-shirts or whatever,
right?
Boxers or briefs, right? It's not a moral absolute, it's just a personal preference. When people argue for state programs, it only gains any emotional or propagandistic power if they appeal to it as a universal absolute. We have to take care of the poor. It is only civilized to take care of the sick. We need public, whatever, right? And that's fine. I mean, they can come up with those theories, But then if they're saying it's a universal absolute, then it, like any scientific theory, it has to actually apply universally. And so you can have something like don't initiate violence that makes perfect sense logically, and universally, that's a moral rule that I think we would all agree with.
Well, more or less, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, I mean, people argue about this sort of self-defense and stuff, but generally people would say, like, don't murder is probably a pretty good moral rule, right? And so if people are saying, that's why I sort of start off that question with, okay, is it just your opinion that we need public health care, or is it an absolute moral rule? And then they say, oh, it's an absolute moral rule. It's like, okay, then prove it to me. Like, I'm not going to assume anything. Just prove it to me, like I don't have any clue what's going on, which is the scientific method, right? You can't assume things with the scientific method. You have to reason from first principles.
What about the question of atheism? If you look at the question of atheism, there is one aspect of the moral argument which you've talked about before, which is this notion of salvation that applies after the sacrifice of Jesus, but not before it. So you've got two moral standards there. One for people who live after Jesus, and one for people who live... Of course, he didn't exist anyway. But one for people who live after it, and one for people who live before it.
Right.
So you've got that moral argument there.
Yeah, for sure, because then you don't have a universal. Now, the Catholics, I believe, they answer that by saying that those people go to limbo and they get out of it later or whatever, right? But, yeah, I mean, that's just all sort of pure nonsense, I think.
But isn't there a way also to apply the moral argument? Well, first of all, there's one obvious way to apply it, and that would be to God.
Sure, yeah. So somebody says, I believe that in God, and you say, okay, if this is like your personal opinion, like I believe that I had a dream last night, is it your personal opinion that's unverifiable? Or is it something that is, you know, absolutely true and God does exist, right? And then if they say it's just a personal opinion, it's like, yeah, I like the band Queen, and, you know, you can part as friends, right? Because the guy's just expressing a personal opinion, not any statement of fact. But if the person then says, no, no, God absolutely does exist, then all you do is you start from the beginning, and you say, okay, well, you know, like I'm a Martian who's 3 years old, explain it.
Yeah, but I was thinking more in terms of, in moral terms. I was thinking more in terms of God being said to be automatically good or standard of good, while the Bible tells us, and the problem of evil also demonstrates that this belief in God implies all sorts of atrocities, which would be considered evil if committed by any other person.
Right, right, right.
Such as the mere fact that God has created a universe which, you know, has hot viruses and flesh-eating viruses and, you know, tornadoes, all the sort of great natural disasters kind of thing, which are things that would be absolutely monstrous when, if any other person created life in such a way, would be considered an absolutely horrible person.
Right.
So.
Well, if you want to hear how the moral argument applies to it, I'll try to do this short, very shortly. A man was talking on a radio program about why it's moral to put people in hell to suffer forever for small sins. And he said, well, okay, here's an analogy. If you step on a beetle, nothing happens to you. If you kill a homeless man, you get into trouble. But if you kill a head of state, you'll be in big trouble. And
right.
You see how this applies to God, you see. If you do a sin against God, well, it's a sin against an infinite person, so therefore it's an infinite sin, therefore hell is moral.
That's very interesting. That is interesting. The notion of hell is extremely problematic from a moral standpoint.
But of course, I would have said this is moral subjectivism.
Well, but you can imagine how useful it is for people in power to have people in the general population believe that if you act against the interests of somebody who is more powerful, the more powerful that person is, the more you should be punished.
Well, yeah,
There's a great quote that Noam Chomsky's written a book called Pirates and Emperors, and he explains the reason behind that title. where, and I thought it was very interesting, he said that I can't remember, it was, I think, Alexander the Great, basically there was this guy who was a pirate. He had one ship, and he was floating all around the Mediterranean way back when, and he was, you know, pillaging the odd vessel and so on, and so they captured this guy finally after years of searching for him, and they dragged him in front of Alexandra, and Alexandra said, you know, basically, you son of a gun, you're a pirate, that's really terrible, why would you do such a thing? And he said, okay, so I'm a pirate, I have one ship. You're an emperor, you have 5,000 ships. I mean, you can't conceivably attack me morally, because you're doing exactly the same thing, but on a far greater scale. And I think that's a very accurate thing. I mean, the line between criminal behavior and state behavior is only one of degree, and the degree is by far weighted on the side of the state. And so I certainly can't imagine why people would ever justify things. And the same thing is true, of course, of organized religions in society and, in
Bingo.
My particular opinion, in parental religious authorities within the home.
Bingo, definitely, you've got it. And we have to go to the intermission. So, what's the intermission about?
Well, I found a website that had an interesting song, and the name of the band escapes me. I'll put it in the newsletter. It's called We Come From Monkeys. Now, yes, we do have a problem with that. It is a pro-evolution, pro-Darwinian song, but I'm sure you guys are smart enough to see the problem with it. Yet, I think their hearts are really in the right place.
Yeah, you know, it's just a funny thing.
And somebody should set them straight, but other than that, it's kind of a funny song.
It's just a funny thing. So, we'll be back with Stefan Molyneux.
It's time for intermission, boys and girls. Take a deep breath. Relax.
Darwin had a revelation. He said all life evolved from the confusion. He had a theory. It made some people nervous when he came to the embarrassing conclusion. We come from monkeys. We're not so special. We've only got a little extra DNA. The chimpanzees are very close to us. Australopithecus, he's not so far away. We come from monkeys swinging in the trees. A little bit of monkey inside you and me. A monkey in the middle, a monkey on your back. It's a fundamental problem, but a scientific fact. We come from monkeys. Minded said creation was the answer. They got upset, then those got out of joint. They say we're missing the monkey in the middle. They're picking it, it gotta prove the point. You're not so hairy, you haven't got a tail. You're not adapted, we're living in a tree. But if you care, count up all your chromosomes. You're 98.4% a chimpanzee. We come from monkeys swinging in the trees. A little bit of monkey inside you and me. A monkey in the middle, a monkey on your back. It's a fundamental problem, but a scientific fact. We come from monkeys.
Double helix monkey bars, feel the primal beast. 6 million years we've been walking on our feet. A barrel full of monkeys swinging from the family tree. We don't want to start a social revolution. We just want to talk about the monkey evolution. But the knuckles back at school, cause we're cool, cause we don't want to see.
We come from monkeys. Can't handle the thought of evolution. You might just call it intelligent design. But if the universe keeps on evolving, then maybe you should just evolve a bigger mind. We come from monkeys swinging in the trees. A little bit of monkey inside you and me. A monkey in the middle, a monkey on your back. It's a fundamental problem, but a scientific fact. We come from monkeys.
see, monkey do, monkey see, monkey do, monkey me, monkey you. Let's all face it, it's all true, we come from monkeys.
Okay, intermission's over. The show must go on.
Wow.
No, it was cool.
Yeah.
It was cool.
It's kind of catchy, I don't know.
But if you don't already know, we don't actually come from monkeys.
At least I don't.
Monkeys and don't. Apes and us and people come from the same place. It's a little bit different. Our fathers, you know, if you look down our ancestor lines, we weren't monkeys, which is, you know, we were actually, if you talk about we, monkeys and gorillas and apes and we,
well, exactly.
Are all equally evolved creatures.
Yeah.
And if you're saying we, well, we were all little tree-climbing, little sloth-looking guys, so... We're all like little, you know, little rodent-looking things. So anyway.
Yeah, it's actually more complicated than that. There's a whole tree of life there. You know, it's like I don't remember exactly, but humans and apes and come together in one point. And
but the stuff about DNA was right on. I mean, we're very much like. Apes, so.
So we talked about the moral argument, or as I like to call it, the moral razor. I guess it depends how you use it. But, okay. So some other, how to argue morality, some other arguments. The second one also applies to atheism and libertarianism, and it's the burden of proof. Now the burden of proof basically says, or at least that's how I use it, basically says that if you make a claim about reality, you have the burden of justifying what you're saying. So, what do you think about that one, Stefan?
Well, I think it's true. I think that if you make a claim about reality that's not immediately centrally evident,
mm-hmm.
or it's not logically consistent with the known facts of reality that everyone experiences,
right.
then I think, like, I don't disbelieve in the existence of Thailand, though I've never been there. So, simply because, but if somebody said that Thailand was a lake of fire that never burnt out and levitated 5 feet in the air, then I would probably ask them to, you know, maybe take me there, or at least smoke the same stuff that they smoked when they saw it. So, that would, you know, if somebody's just saying, well, you know, China exists, I'd be like, okay, well, I've been to China, but I mean, if I hadn't, I would be like, okay. So China's a country, I've seen pictures, I've met people from China, I hear the music, it's either an enormously elaborate, unbelievable post, or, you know, China exists. So I'm willing to accept a fair amount of stuff that's consistent with the known facts of reality as I've directly experienced them.
Yeah.
But when somebody, like if somebody says to me in the Middle Ages, the world is not flat, but it's round, and the Earth is moving at, like, thousands of miles a second, and, you know, the Earth is, like, way smaller than the sun, and the sun is way bigger than the moon, I'd be skeptical. I'd be like, okay, it really doesn't look that way to me, so you've got to kind of make the case, right?
Well, and, now like, you're going more into the epistemic issue of how to deal with a strong limit of knowledge.
Go ahead. Tell me a little more about that.
Well, what I mean is you're talking about what do you do if your context of knowledge is not very great, and someone tells you, you know, a hypothetical situation where someone knows the truth, and, you know, how to deal with your extreme limit of knowledge in terms of being able to understand the truth of the matter. Well, I think it's kind of a separate issue. I mean, in our modern day and age, I think we have more than enough understanding to be able to arrive at conclusions regarding the issues that we're talking about. What we're talking about specifically is government versus no government and God versus no God. I think these are pretty subtle issues, if anyone takes the care to look at the evidence.
Right, right. And I think that the one thing that you do, at least that I do, is I try to, there's a couple of things that are logical and a couple of things that are more emotional, but I think still quite powerful. I prefer to talk about the existence of Zeus or of gods or of leprechauns, not of God, because that has all these emotional connotations for people, right? They're unconscious, they're expecting lightning bolts to come from a clear blue sky and their ancestors to come back to dead from the dead and strangle them or something like that, right? But if you just seem talking about Zeus, right? Or, you know, what I like is an interesting game, and I wrote about this in my last novel, where somebody is being cross-examined by the Catholic board in the Middle Ages, and they're saying, don't you believe that God exists? And I say, the woman who's being examined says, well, I have no idea what you mean when you say God. Let's just make up another word and tell me, like, what you mean, because they say, let's just call it Nog, right? So N-O-G. And you prove to me that Nog exists, and they say, well, Nog is all-powerful and all-knowing. It's like, well, you're just describing characteristics of something, but it's mm-hmm. proof that exists, right? I can say that, oh, if Nog exists, you say, well, I don't think it does. And I say, well, Nog is blue. And you're like, oh, okay, well, then it does exist, right? It doesn't make any sense, right?
I prefer to
not deal with the idea of God, that sort of singular term, the monotheistic, usually Christian or Judeo-Christian deity, because that's got a lot of emotional connotations from people. But if you just talk about leprechauns, then people find it a lot more, you get a lot further a lot more quickly. And then once you get them to establish the idea of leprechauns and how silly it is to believe that leprechauns exist, then you can say, well, what about Zeus? And then finally you can get to, what about a Christian God? And I always try, like, not God, because that's just too emotional for people, at least I find, but a God or the Christian God or the Christian deity or something like that.
Right.
I find it's a lot more helpful to get people over that emotional hump of just feeling that they're going to get punished somehow.
I understand.
You ever tried that? I mean, that's something I found.
Well, not me personally, but the whole meaninglessness argument, which is what you're talking about, is also another interesting, although it's not a moral type of argument, it's also an interesting argument, and I think it also applies to government. Because the notion of government is inherently meaningless. So I think you can really get the same kind of dynamics here, in terms of, you know, the standard way of arguing it is saying, well, what if you have one person stealing from another, two people, five people, 10 people, 100 people, 1,000 people, 1,000,000 people.
Yeah, when
you know, you get into that hole. Yeah.
Right. Right, and absolutely, and it's very hard. I mean, we live in this fantasy castle of conceptual constructions. This is where everybody lives, because we just don't reason from first principles anymore. It's a Western habit, and it's so sad, because we're the culture that developed it, and then we're the culture that threw it out, about 200 years ago, and it's the saddest thing in the world. It's like you've got the cure for cancer, and then you just accidentally threw it out with the garbage.
Yeah,
and it is very sad, but if you reason from first principles, these things are actually very simple. And because they're very simple to answer, basically the state and the church and the family have to spend so much effort and time and money and everything just to get people to ignore the basic facts that it takes about 10 seconds to think about and solve.
Mm-hmm. To me, the main advantage of the burden of proof is not necessarily that as anarchists we don't have to fulfill it. I think it's relatively easy for us to fulfill it. But I think the main advantage of the argument is that it really kind of breaks the illusion that we have, because statism is so, seems to crowd out everything else. And it kind of breaks the illusion that anarchists are the ones who have to prove everything, in my
opinion. Yeah, no, I think that's quite right. I think that's quite right. And it is the people who have to take the people who end up with the burden of proof are always at a disadvantage, especially if they're crazy. Right?
Yeah.
So anarchists are at a disadvantage simply because you're trying to disprove a negative, right? Which is that something which doesn't exist shouldn't exist, right? Like the government. And that's impossible.
True.
So you know, as I've argued before, if you don't use the argument for morality, that sort of 3-year-old Columbo approach, you have to end up running around getting so many statistics and so many facts, and I'll get back to you about the gold rush standard crash of 1862 in Arkansas.
Exactly.
You know, I know something. I mean, what a nightmare that is, right? You've got to become this really boring human encyclopedia of every fact. How would roads work in Siberia in the 24th century? Wait, I'll go work that out and get back to you. And it's really so much more simple than that, right? I mean, the burden of proof, if somebody proposes a moral theory, like we need socialized medicine, we need the welfare state, the army is good.
Right.
Then
you have the burden of proof.
Yeah, they have the burden of proof. You don't actually have to lift a finger. You say, okay, well, I don't believe that that's true, so you do the work. Instead of the libertarians, we run around like, you know, like ferrets on a double espresso. We leave footprints all over the ceiling of the library and on the internet looking everything up to prove everything to people. And that's a fundamentally, I think, a weak approach and not a very productive approach. And it's a vaguely desperate approach. It's like, if I can just get you to believe in libertarianism based on a bunch of facts that I can give you, but that's never going to work.
No.
People are fundamentally motivated by morality, not by the argument of effect.
Exactly.
You're just bringing me back to... I was 16 years old, and we were having a mock election in class. This is public school, of course. And the instructor tells us to tell everyone who we voted for. And in each election, and I had voted for a libertarian candidate. And I had one of those moments that you get in dreams where everyone is laughing and pointing at you.
Right.
I was kind of at a disadvantage there. I mean, where could I have even started on that at 16? But...
Well, you are raised, I mean, in any school, you're not going to learn about that, so.
Well, we're talking about 1984.
Oh, ironic.
But let's see, yeah, it was Reagan's second term. Anyway.
The schools won't even need to teach you about democracy.
Well, I mean,
whatever.
Where could I have started? I could have started on the futility of voting. I don't know if I could have started there or not. because we are forced to vote.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's like trying to read Shakespeare to somebody who doesn't speak English. You've got to really be in it for the long haul if you want to take that approach, for sure.
But it's very easy to show that the famous position is fundamentally wrong, immoral, joke. And the third argument is, this is more of my kind of argument, things that I've discussed on my blog, by presenting natural moral assumptions and how government belief or God belief breaks those assumptions. For example, of course, in the case of religion, it's pretty easy. You talk about things like justice and how everyone believes in justice and how this whole notion of original sin and the sacrifice of a person for someone else and all that sort of thing is completely counterintuitive to our moral assumptions. In the case of government, I would say, for example, war, you know, most people agree that the war is wrong, that war is something that's not very positive, you know, unless, of course, you are raised on a post-World War II war porn.
No, I'm sorry, I have to object to that because where I grew up, people were not, if you said you were against war, that made you a pacifist, and that's a bad thing. So I don't think most people in America, at least, and I was in a liberal state, would agree that war is automatically bad.
Yeah, but you're in the U.S., that's different. I'm talking about normal people.
That's good. If you have an objection, just keep slicing the definition. That's great.
Okay, fine, you do better. Go ahead.
I think that most people, this is why I said murder, right? Most people would admit that unprovoked murder is bad.
Okay, and let's use the example of murder then.
Sure.
So, let's say, for example, everyone agrees that murder is wrong, and then you can get into the issue of war from there, couldn't you?
I just have a hard time with it to begin with, because if you want to get into the moral argument, there's just too many damn people who think that morality is completely subjective to culture.
Well, and that's fine. But see, those people are pretty easy to counter as well, in my humble opinion. Obviously, you can tell me if I'm speaking out of the wrong...
Well, go ahead.
But it's really, because, you know, if somebody says morality is completely subjective, right, then it's obvious that you can't impose morality on other people, because it's subjective.
Yeah.
It's like a preference for a color. I can't make everyone like blue or whatever. So I can't pass a law that says everyone should like blue, and so if people believe that morality is subjective, then you can't have a government for sure.
You know, I've never
there
thought
you go.
About that.
That's
a great
simple.
Argument.
That's so I've, simple.
That's a great argument. I never thought about that. Wow. you.
Hey, look, I was finally helpful.
Well, okay, but they might
no,
backtrack.
No, it was
going to
happen
say,
sooner or later after 150 podcasts. I was going to
well,
come up with something.
They do. They might backtrack and say, "Well, morality is subjective to your culture." So, but of course, at that point, you have to get them to define what culture is and where are the boundaries of culture. You know.
Well, you know, I'm just doing this show to try to help people out that are listening to our show to argue morality. You know, how to argue morality. That's
sorry.
The whole
I
point.
Just you say morality is subjective except for culture.
No, morality, they say morality is subjective to cultures. So like,
also within cultures.
Right, so if you're in this culture, because of this culture, this thing is wrong, and because of this culture, this thing is right, so it's good for them, but it's evil for those people.
Right, which is basically, it's collective relativism, right?
Right.
It's everything's relative, but too collective or whatever, right?
And they're good friends of ours who do profess this.
Who's then?
Right, but I mean, that's
Eller?
Also, I mean, relatively, okay. Again, in my humble opinion, it's relatively simple to counter, because all you would then have to ask is, to what degree do you have evidence that people within a culture all believe the same thing? I mean, if they're saying that everyone in a culture believes the same thing, and therefore it's not relative within that culture, then you just have to say, okay, so Canada's a culture, right? So then does that mean that everyone in Canada believes the same thing? Well, of course they don't, right?
Well, you can't pin them down to what a culture is, because obviously there are subcultures within countries that can span different continents. You know, you've got like gypsies, you've got all kinds of different people. You can't really define them, but what they would say is if you have this amorphous sort of thing called a culture, the majority decides, you know, what's right and the minority is wrong.
Well, that's great, but that also means that you can't have a state, right? Because a state is a geographical entity, and they're saying culture is not geographically specific.
Exactly.
So you have a mismatch, right?
There you go.
The state is going to enforce the same rules in a geography, and if you've got gypsies going in and out, just to take one example, right, or you've got immigrants coming into that and then other people leaving, because it's fixed and geographical, even if they say cultural subjectivism is the way to go, you still can't have a government.
And it's
also... You don't have, like, what we call DLOs. I mean, you would just have those local sort of voluntary organizations.
And they're also making quite a few assumptions about what this particular culture believes, the majority of this culture believes. Like if you say, well, Arabs all agree or Muslims all agree that honor killings are good.
Right, except
you don't
for the women
know that.
Maybe, yeah, except for the women who are on the receiving end, maybe.
Right, right. Well, of course they would say, relatively, subjectively, those women are immoral.
Okay, but listen, you guys, all that I'm saying with this argument is,
okay.
You have to use, what I'm saying is you have to use people's natural moral assumptions. But I'm not saying they're necessarily objective or that they're necessarily, everyone's going to agree with them. Well, what I'm saying is you can look at people's natural moral assumptions. For example, that murder is wrong, the theft is wrong, etc., and show how government breaks them. How the concept of government breaks those assumptions.
Right,
you understand what I mean?
Right, even if they are kind of subjective.
Yeah. But if they're subjective, like you said, you can simply show how government contradicts that too.
Right.
Because it's trying to impose a singular value system on it.
As in the government that outlawed honor killings.
But the burden of proof, of course, is still going to remain upon the people who say that morality is culturally subjective.
Yeah.
You still have to prove that, right? Because there's no such thing as culture except in a petri dish, right? So, and, you know, when I was a bachelor in my shower. But they still have to prove that basic thesis. So there's no such thing as culture, there's only individuals. So let's say that there's an island called Micronesia, everyone is over there, they say they're all part of one culture. Well, if things are culturally subjective, then it means the only way to prove that would be that everybody who lives on Micronesia believes all exactly the same things. In which case, you still don't need a state because there's no contradiction in values. If there is a contradiction in values, then you obviously don't have cultural uniformity, right? Which raises the case for a state, but then also destroys the other sort of major position that they have. So if people all agree, then you don't need a state. And if people don't agree, then there's no such thing as this sort of subjectivity thing.
They don't have any justification to begin with.
Right, right.
Their justification is undercut. That's a very good argument, too.
Wow.
We're just learning. But unfortunately, our learning will have to be cut short because we only have 2 minutes left. So I don't know
if... No problem.
So I don't know, Stefan, if you want to go ahead and give our listeners some tips on how to argue morality, or for the...
Yeah, go in low with your elbows wide, and take no prisoners. Well, you know, it's practice, and, you know, the thing that I find, and this sounds pretty weird, maybe, coming from a rationalist, you kind of have to relax your mind into nothingness. You have to be receptive. No, it's true. I mean, it really does help. Because as soon as you go out and try and prove something to someone, you're going to hook into all their prejudice and all this and that, you know, and just the thing that I can't emphasize too much, it's really the Socratic approach, and it's a very powerful thing. Just say, I don't understand.
You become the three-year-old Martian.
Yeah, the three-year-old Martian is beautiful. I mean, Voltaire wrote a lot about this, and there was quite a bit of writing about this in the 18th century, you know, what would a Martian think if they came to the court of Louis XVI? I mean, this is pretty famous stuff. It's not really in vogue anymore because things are even more ludicrous in some ways now than they were back then. But that is a very, very attractive approach. The other thing that I've mentioned on a podcast recently is that you can also just say that you don't understand something that somebody's saying, which they're absolutely convinced of, and just say, like, as I mentioned on my podcast, my friend was complaining that his credit history, his credit report had gone down, his credit rating. And I was like, well, what's wrong with that? Like, he was so certain that it was the wrong thing, and I just was curious, and I'm like, well, I don't understand what's wrong with that. You chose to do that for X, Y, and Z reasons, so you know, you got those benefits, and it cost you this, but you wanted that cost benefit, so what's wrong with it? And so that can be another helpful thing, when people just assume and say, well, you know, we can't do this, or we have to do that. It's like, well, why? I don't understand. Like, why would we? I'm just out of curiosity. Why would we have to do this, or why can't we do that? And that can also be helpful, because, you know, basically people are trapped in their own propaganda, or not their own, but in the propaganda that's within the culture, and they're fighting for air as much as we're fighting to free them. Right? They just don't really know it yet. And the best way to do it is not to lecture them. I mean, despite what I'm doing now. But, hey, But the best way to do it is not to lecture them, but to sort of be curious, keep asking questions. And that way, if they're interested in breaking free of their prejudices, then you can give them a way out. But if you kind of like you don't understand, and if they just get angry or irritable or contemptuous, then it's like, okay, no problem. You do the Socrates thing and you keep moving because you're never going to convert that person anyway.
All right, Stefan, I'm going to have to cut you there because this is the end of the show.
Wait, freedomainradio.com. Okay.
Yes, of course. Check out the blog and the famous podcast. Why don't you give our coordinates?
Yes, you can also find out more about our station where we play his podcast every day at 4 p.m. Eastern Time at www.hellboundalley.com. And if you have any questions, please feel free to email me at Allie@hellboundalley.com. That's ALLEE.
And on our live show this Sunday, we'll have Eric Johnson of Quickstar Blog to talk about the Amway scam. And next week, it's the abortion debate with Stefan and the Raving Atheist.
All right.
That should be very interesting.
We got some
Stefan?
Juicy stuff coming up.
Next, when is that again?
Next week.
Or no, it's March 25th.
Yes.
Okay. Beautiful. How about
that, 2 o'clock? Yeah, as usual.
Beautiful.
So we'll see you guys next week, and thank you very much, Stefan.
Okay, then.
Goodbye.
Hey, next week, everybody.